afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Acton. Glad you could join us. Our guest this hour is Minnesota Republican Senator Rod Grams. Senator Grams is back in Minnesota following last week's tumultuous World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle and following the end of this year's congressional session in Washington, a session which you'll recall started last January with some tumultuous fireworks over impeachment, but ended rather quietly a couple of weeks ago. Looking ahead to the new year, of course, Senator Grams is up for re-election next year, and several Democrats and one reformer have already announced their plans to try to unseat him, with more potential candidates waiting in the wings. Lots to talk about today, policy, politics, and we invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call here. Our guest is Minnesota Republican Senator Rod Grams, and if you have a question for Senator Grams, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Senator Grams, thanks for coming in today.
Gary, my pleasure.
We should be quite a pair today, between the two Coles that we've got here, kind of matching.
I was just thinking about that, if we can cough in unison or clear our throats. But again, it's great to be here.
Let me ask you about the World Trade meeting in Seattle. What was going on out there in your mind? I mean, obviously there was some violence and a huge number of protesters and concerns all over the map. It seems like people are just very uneasy about where the world is heading.
Well, I think it's, you know, like most things in our lives, we don't want to see changes or major changes done in short periods of time. But I think we've got to accept the fact that, you know, we're now in a global type economy. Trade to countries around the world is so important to our markets. In fact, in Minnesota, more than a third of all of our agricultural commodities are exported. And then you look into our high-tech industry, our medical device industry, and all of these really survive and grow on exports. You know, the jobs that we have, the number of jobs, the strength of our economy. So what we're trying to do, and what WTO was, I think, basically all about, was trying to begin to set another agenda to begin to continue, or continue, not to begin, but continue efforts on leveling the playing field so that it's easier for us to compete for those markets around the world. And right now there are, say, our tariffs average about 8%. Worldwide, they average about 50%. So it's harder for our companies, our goods and services, to get into those markets. And then if you look in agricultural areas, about 82% of all the subsidies in the world over the last 3 years have come out of Europe, only 1.4% from the United States. So it's hard for our farmers to compete against the treasuries of, say, France or Germany. So these talks were aimed at trying to knock those or lower those subsidies, reduce the tariffs and other barriers that really will give us a better opportunity to expand our markets, which is good for our jobs, our farmers, etc. So I don't know. I know there was some concern. I think a lot of it had to do over workers' rights, environmental standards, etc. Those were a lot of things we heard in the streets. Those should be considered, and I think will be. But at the same time, we've got to let, I think, trade grow, which in turn, I think, helps economies grow, better wages, better jobs worldwide. And then you can also begin to have more concern over the environment and other issues. So I think you've got to use this as building blocks. You can't have it all at once.
Can you take those other concerns, the labor rights, the human rights, environmental issues and so on, can you take those and bring them into a room where trade deals are negotiated? Do they belong there in your mind?
I don't think they do. I think trade is one thing and working on these other issues are another. Now, I know there's many that want to link them together. The president has made those type of comments. Many other groups have as well. And it's not that we're not concerned about them. I mean, everybody is. I mean, we're all concerned about the human rights, religious persecutions, working standards, environmental concerns. But should they all be linked to trade? In other words, if we can't have those, we won't have a trade agreement. Again, I think they're part of the building block process. And a lot of the reasons that I understand why some of these talks broke down right at the end is that many of the countries were not willing to accept some of the conditions the U.S. was placing, and that is dealing with the workers' issues, environmental standards, et cetera. And that's what I understand led to the breakdown of a lot of these talks and the failure to reach any kind of an agreement. So right now we've got to say is no agreement, or is a the agreements we lost, would it have been better to have those than none at all?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you were specifically interested in the whole area of agricultural trade and trying to increase exports.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, for example, the sugar industry is not real interested in eliminating all barriers of trade, and we have a big sugar industry here.
Right.
How do you reconcile all those competing interests, even within one sector, say agriculture?
Well, I think, let's take sugar, for instance. There are, you know, there is a sugar program in this country, and that basically offers some protection for our sugar growers. But really what it does is protect them from a distorted trade situation. In other words, there are other countries that heavily subsidize their sugar industry. And that means that production then, the excess production, can be dumped onto the world market for less price than what it costs to produce it there or even produce it here. And we're the largest consuming market. So what we would see is basically surplus sugar from basically distorted or heavily subsidized sugar programs in other countries, then just being dumped into our market, which could destroy our industry. So when we have a level playing field, I think our industry is willing and able to compete against foreign producers. But again, it's the same thing of trying to put our sugar producers up against a heavily subsidized program in other countries. In other words, so that distorts the market. It's like going onto a football field and they've got 11 players and you've got only five. You know, it's hard to play the game when the rules aren't the same. So what we're saying is if they could equalize so we have the same trade advantages or disadvantages, then our sugar industry would be willing and I think would have to compete on a worldwide basis. And we would do that, or, you know, in talks with them, they'd be willing to do that. I think we have the best and highest producing, you know, sugar industry, but it can't compete in a distorted market. So once that's, I think that goes back to what the WTO was trying to do, is level those playing fields so we have to knock down those old programs, but we can't do it until other countries knock down their programs.
Are you concerned, Senator, that by getting involved in organizations like the World Trade Organization, that the U.S. is giving up much of its sovereignty, and that ultimately an international organization like that is going to be dictating domestic policy in this country?
No, and we can't go that far as to give up that type of rights or give up the issues of sovereignty at all. But it's the same. I mean, if we're going to be competing in these markets, I think there has to be some rules and regulations that govern that. And I think to work out those type of agreements does not mean we have to give up sovereignty to do it. And what the WTO also represents is not a dictatorial type organization, but one that is there to hear a complaint. So if we, you know, are thought to be trading, doing things that are not up to what the agreement calls for, so it's like we're cheating on the agreement, other countries could lodge complaints against us, and then the World Trade Organization would act basically as a court. And we would do the same if we thought there was dumping in our country, say steel was being dumped on our shores, or sugar or something else. But I would stop way short of giving any kind of authority to the WTO that would dictate anything dealing with our sovereignty or our ability to make decisions that are good for us in the future. So whether it's dealing with our, you know, high-tech industry, our medical industry, our agricultural industries, or anything else, we have to look after us first. But at the same time, we can be winners if we have the opportunity to trade worldwide.
One more question on the subject before we get to some callers. China.
Mm-hmm.
There are a good many people, including good many people in your party, who say that China should not be allowed to enter the World Trade Organization, that we're making a horrible mistake by supporting that effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been a supporter of it. And China is going to be there, and it's going to be a superpower sooner rather than later. It's a huge market. It's a market that could prove beneficial to us. Do we have concerns about some of the things in China? Sure. You know, we've, you know, talked many times about the human rights issues, the religious persecution issues, etc. But by closing the doors to China does not improve the situation. Our businessmen and women and the contacts that we have are some of the best ambassadors that our country can offer. And I've been to China several times, and I've seen the growing middle class there. And the more exposure they have to the West or to other countries and their products and their forms of government, etc., I think the middle class, the growing middle class in China, will put more pressure on their government to change than we could from the outside. So again, I think this is a series of building blocks. We're not going to change China overnight. China is not going to change China overnight. But I think continuing exposure and having our people there works wonders toward that way. China has changed a lot in 10 years. But then also they talk about most favored nation status. But really, that's normal trade relations. This is what we offer or with every other country in the world. So it's not that China is being offered anything special or different as far as their trade relations with us, although that's what MFN has always stood for, most favored nation. It's been changed now to NTR, or normal trade relations. But again, it's on par with England, Germany, any other country that we trade with. So it's no special thing for China. But again, China is out there. It's a huge market. It needs us, and we need it as far as our ability to continue to grow. So I think China should be entered into the WTO.
Minnesota Senator Rod Grams is our guest this hour. He's come by today to take your questions. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828. Bob, go ahead, please.
As you know, Senator, President Clinton is scheduled to make a decision next summer on deployment of a supposedly limited national missile defense system.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a recent report by an independent panel appointed by the Pentagon that shows that a decision on deploying a technologically feasible anti-missile system cannot possibly be made by that time, because the anti-missile program has serious testing and management problems. In addition, as you know very well, both Russia and China vigorously opposed modification of the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, which prohibits deployment of the proposed system. According to their arguments, if we go ahead and deploy an anti-missile defense, that would cause Russia, for example, to hang on to its huge arsenal of 10,000 nuclear weapons, if not build more. And the Chinese indicate that they would expand their nuclear arsenal to compensate for our possible defense, undercutting their ability to deter a nuclear attack. So my question, Senator, is how can you support approving a decision next year to deploy a national missile defense system when there's no evidence that it would be technologically feasible to deployment? Secondly, when there is substantial evidence that it would be destabilizing regarding Russian and Chinese nuclear weapons? And thirdly, when the decision basically is based on two dubious assumptions, namely that North Korea, Iran, or Iraq would choose to commit suicide by attacking our country with nuclear weapons, and secondly, that they would be sufficiently stupid to use the one means of delivering a nuclear weapon that our anti-missile defense system might be effective against rather than a suitcase bomb?
Well, as you know, the Senate has gone on record in support of the missile defense system, and I have been a supporter of that. Would it have negative effects on what you've talked about, our agreements, our old weapons agreements with the Soviet Union, which no longer exist, and Russia? It might. That you said that it is not technologically possible at this time. I mean, the testing goes on, and that's what the funding was for, was to continue development of this. There have been some recent successes in these tests. So, but the bottom line is, if this is going to provide defense for this country, whether it be from, say, Russia, which is unlikely probably right now, but more likely from rogue nations or terrorists, I think we've got to provide every possible defense that we can. And so that's why I've been supporting it. And it probably wouldn't come just from North Korea, but maybe from terrorist groups associated with that. But there is a grave possibility. And most people, when you tell them that we don't have a system that could defend against missiles, they wonder why. So I've been a strong supporter of it. I have voted for it, and we're moving ahead on it. And I, you know, like I said, I hope the testing continues to improve.
Gary, your question for Senator Grams?
Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Grams.
Yes, Gary.
Hi there. Why do you feel you represent the people of Minnesota in running again for senator? And mainly on your voting record has always been party line vote. You don't switch over. Even your your closest competitor there, Mr. Paul Wellstone, he's crossed over several times against his own party on certain bills. Your bills all seem to fall in one category, right, with the party. Can you explain that to the people?
Well, I don't follow the party line vote, although I'm glad the party does agree with me in the majority of times. Is there times when I have crossed over? Yes, there have been, and my voting record, you know, will show that. But when you say why or do I represent the people of Minnesota, I don't know where you draw the line on that, but do I support good education? Yes. Do I want great health care for our people? Yes, I do. Do we want the best medical system and the best delivery of medical care? Yes. So there's no time that I ever am in Washington that I vote against the people of Minnesota. So, you know, I'm just going to continue to work on the same issues that I campaigned on in 92 and 94, and that is to try lower our taxes because I think there's a lot of waste in abuse of the budget in Washington. I think we need to downsize the federal government, and that doesn't mean to get rid of it. We need a strong federal government, but we need one that is more accountable and especially on the way it spends our money. And we also have to look at regulation to make sure that we're getting our dollars worth for every dollar we spend. And so there's a lot of things that we need to do that I've continued to work on and tried to champion for the people of Minnesota. So, you know, I'm going to continue to work on that. And if it means voting one way or even voting against my party, I voted against the budget again, which was not a party line vote by any means, because I was not happy with the way the budget was put together. Some of the things that were done to try to attain the balanced budget that we have, and also the entire budget process. So there's many times that I voted against things that you would call maybe party line votes. But every time I go to the floor to vote, I don't look over my shoulder to see how Trent Lott is voting. I look over and see how is this going to affect the country and how is it going to affect the people of Minnesota. And that's how I determine whether I'm going to vote yes or no.
Senator, what happened on that dairy business at the end of the session? The dairy, the Northeast Dairy Compact, I believe it was called, and dairy farmers around here wanted that scotched, and it was scotched, and then all of a sudden, right at the end, it got put back in. What was that all about?
Well, it's like a bad penny. It just doesn't want to go away. We've defeated it twice in the last 3 years on the floor of the Senate. It was defeated also once in 1996, I believe it was. So three times it's been up for votes, and all three times it's been defeated. But it's been the political clout by a number of senators, including Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, and Jim Jeffords, a Republican from Vermont. But somehow they've been able to bring it back to life by sticking it into bills during conference committees. And then it comes back in a conference report, or as in this case, this year in the omnibus budget bill, where we had no chance to, you know, vote it up or down or pull it out. It was just a matter, do you vote for the omnibus bill or not? And that's another reason why I voted against the budget as well, because, again, it was political chicanery that kept this alive. And I was very opposed to it, worked very hard to try to kill it. And like I said, we did kill it twice on the floor, but we didn't have the opportunity. We did get a commitment from the leadership that we would be able to bring it back and revisit the issue early again next year. And so that's all we can do is continue to fight on this.
Brian, your question, please.
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple of comments. One being on the nuclear defense system. I think that's a good program to invest in and go ahead with. And to an earlier caller, comment about, you know, possible rogue nation, you know, why would they risk that? I mean, how can we risk something possibly happening like that? I mean, that could risk a lot of lives, even if it was one instance. And I think the focus of our government is really to protect our citizens.
It would be hard to explain, wouldn't it, if a missile happened to get through and people would say, we assume that we had this covered, and we didn't. So we should, as you mentioned, Brian, take all precautions.
Yeah. And then I wanted to make a comment about Social Security. I know in a lot of your policies, and to another caller, you've really we could use more leadership like yours in working for working families and trying to make things better. And I know something of your Social Security policy plan on privatizing it, and it sounds very interesting. I think it could help a lot of people, particularly in their 20s and 30s. In their 40s. So if you kind of maybe speak to the Social Security plan, what's involved, how it might be implemented, and how that could benefit working people.
Well, as you know, Brian, or maybe you don't know, but I've introduced twice now a bill called the Personal Wealth and Security and Retirement Act, and that basically is a bill to move Social Security from the current pay-as-you-go system we have today to a fully funded private retirement accounts. And I'm holding a series of town hall meetings while I'm back in Minnesota over these next 2 months. And in fact, I just held one out in White Bear Lake Township yesterday, and many seniors attended the meeting. But real quickly on the program, it guarantees that all seniors that are on Social Security today or want to retire with Social Security as their program, we guarantee all their benefits will be there. No raise in the age, no raise in taxes, no decline in their benefits, but also to give younger people the opportunity or the option to go into a personal retirement account rather than staying with the current system, but it would be their option. And in the many of the meeting yesterday were senior citizens, many on retirement today, and they realized that this plan would not jeopardize their retirement benefits, but also when they're thinking about their children and their grandchildren, they want to make sure that they have the best retirement system available to them. And by far, according to the numbers and figures that we have, the personal accounts would do much better. And I'm also, if you, there's a couple of places that already have private retirement accounts. One is Galveston County, Texas, 18 years, and it outperforms the Social Security system at least 5-1. The city of San Diego, all the public employees there have their own private retirement accounts, not Social Security, again, outperforming the current system. The country of Chile is one of 12 around the world that have gone to private retirement accounts, replacing old Social Security systems similar to ours, and are doing much better than our system. So we like to think that we're always ahead of the curve on many things. But when it comes to retirement, we're really lagging behind, and we need to have a full and open debate, whether it's if my plan would be approved or any of the others that are out there. But what is important is that the American people get more information over the next couple of years so they can help us make the decision whatever direction we go. But bottom line is we got to have a system that is safe, sound, and reliable for our retirees.
Practical matter, Senator, when might that full discussion on Social Security actually occur? Now, we've been hearing that we need this discussion for quite some long while, but of course next year is an election year, so it's unlikely that anything is going to be done about it next year again. How long into the future will it be before Congress will actually address the issue of Social Security?
Well, we tried to get the debate started last year. I attended the White House conference, a two-day conference on Social Security reform. It, you know, went through a lot of things, but came out with no conclusions. But also, the president tried to revive it a little bit in September, you know, bringing up the issue, but it was not going to be time this year to debate it. But it should come up next year, and when I say come up, I hope it's part of the presidential debates. You know, I'd like to know where Al Gore stands on it. I'd like to know where Bill Bradley stands on this issue, where George W. Bush, where Mr. Forbes, where Gary Bauer and all the Republicans, McCain, etc. And I think the American voters would like to know, because this is a very important thing. Social Security is in trouble. It needs to have some reforms, or it's not going to survive under the current system. The demographics are making the system is going to collapse. So we've got to do something in order to secure retirement in the future. And I think all the voters out there should know where the candidates stand. So I hope it comes up as a major part of the debates in this presidential year, because it almost has to be a mandate to move it in the legislation in the Congress. And I think it would become that kind of a mandate if one of the presidents or whoever's elected president would push his plan that he campaigns on. And also at the same time, I think Congress will have an opportunity. I want to, you know, bring it up next year. And so what I think we'll do next year is at least set the stage in the year 2000 for the debate and get the information out so the public becomes more aware of what some of the options are. And then after the elections, when we move into the year 2001, I think there will be very early and very serious considerations on how the plan will be changed.
Our guest this hour is Minnesota Republican Senator Rod Grams. He's come by today to take your questions. Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Minnesota Senator Rod Grams. And again, if you've got a question for the Senator, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go back to the phones. Mike's on the line from Duluth. Mike?
Hi, good afternoon, Senator.
Hi, Mike.
My question is, or my comment is, regarding the incident in Anoka County, I was kind of disappointed when I read the Star Tribune letter that you wrote that you didn't address the actions of the sheriff in Anoka County. And I understand what your son's going through, because I think we all know family or friends that are going through the same thing. But my question is, an average citizen like myself, that would have happened to me, do you think I would have been treated in the same manner that your son was treated?
All right. Well, Mike, I don't know because I wasn't there, and it's hard for me to comment until the review is completed, which should be hopefully within a week or so. All I can, you know, talk about is, you know, my involvement, and that is the call that I made out of the concern that I had. And so what happened at the point of after the stop was made, et cetera, I don't know. And again, I'm going to leave all that, and I'm willing to let the chips fall where they may. If there were mistakes made, we'll know about it after this review has been completed by the Dakota County Sheriff's Office. And but I would not expect any special treatment. I don't know if there was any special treatment given. And but again, we'll just find out. So it would be hard for me to address that, and that's why I didn't address it in the letter, was because of the, you know, the current review, and it's hard for me to jump to conclusions or say something that I don't have the information to make a statement that I could, you know, swear to. So
the Star Tribune was criticized for reporting that story regarding your son and your request for help and so on and so forth. Is that criticism legitimate? Was that a legitimate story for the Star Tribune to pursue?
Well, you know,
I think you are a public official, and
right. I think it's the way the story was presented. It was presented with the implication that I had asked for special treatment and that my son received special treatment and some of the things dealing with his past and present, etc. But then you also listen to the Star Tribune saying, well, what we were trying to get at is if there was some things done improperly by the Anoka County Sheriff's Office is what we were trying to get at. Well, you know, what they say they were trying to do and what the story implied to me, I think, were two different things. The implications came across very strong and very loud and clear that it was aimed more at me and my requests, and that's why this story has been picked up in other areas of the country, because it would be, I think, news if there was a senator trying to use his influence in this way, which I never did. And but that was the implication in the story. So, you know, should they report it on it? I guess, you know, news is news and judgments are made on that. It hurts when you're involved, when you see your son's picture on the front page of the paper for several days. But yet, you know, again, they're saying, well, they were just going and looking at what was done by the sheriff's office. So I have a lot of concern on the way it was presented, yes. And the impact it's had on my son, I know I'm not proud of what he's done, neither is he. Should he be facing the consequences? He will. I've never tried to step between him and the law, but I've always been there to support him at the same time. I think any parent would. But our kids have to face their consequences for their action. And so that's why I'm willing to, you know, wait for this review to be completed. And I hope it gets the same kind of coverage as the initial story did, because I think it's going to, you know, bear out that, well, whatever comes out of the review.
Has this whole matter given you pause in terms of your position on the so-called war on drugs? Do you think perhaps that over time we've become too focused on arresting people and the like, and not perhaps spend as much time as we should on treatment and education?
Well, you know, the votes I have taken have been both on, you know, getting tough and cracking down on this crime, but also trying to expand the amount of treatment available, et cetera, because it is something that I think our kids and our nation need. Does it do any good just to throw them in jail? No. And do they need treatment? Yes. And so I've worked both ways. And, you know, we've been fighting with this problem with my son for a number of years. So my votes have, you know, come even though I know what we've been experiencing in my own family. But sometimes if you don't have these arrests or being tough on this, I think we could even be doing our kids a disservice, because if they get further into trouble, you know, the consequences could even be worse. So I think we've, you know, got to continue our efforts to fight drugs. And we also got to continue our efforts to provide the treatment that they need, because so many times, you know, good rehabilitation can make them good, productive citizens of society, and that's what we all strive for, and, you know, that's what I'm striving for.
Should we back off some of those federal minimum sentences, though, which have There are immense numbers of people in the federal prisons on drug charges doing long, long sentences what many people would consider to be lesser crimes.
Right. And, you know, there are some good arguments to that. But, you know, I kind of break it down in two categories, too. If you're a seller or if you're profiting from this, then I think we should be very tough on that, if that's, you know, what the charge against you is or what it is. But, you know, if you're, you know, addicted to it and a user, then I think there can be options rather than just long jail terms, and that is to, you know, seek, you know, help, treatment, rehabilitation, et cetera. So I think there are, you know, different categories that we have to look at this. Drug pushers, those who sell drugs and smuggle drugs in, I think we should be very tough on those. But also at the same time, we need to enforce the laws. And but I think, you know, treatment and rehabilitation are very important parts of that as well.
Scott, your question?
Yes, thank you. First, I wanted to say to the senator that I'm sorry that he's having this turmoil in his family. There's a lot of us out here that have had similar challenges in our families, and so we'll reach out to you for that. I wanted to get your impression, if I could, please, about genetically engineered agriculture. There's we hear a lot about it in the WTO talks, and it seems like free trade goes both ways. It protects the seller as well as the buyer, and yet we seem to be forcing it on Europeans. Mm-hmm. And then also, related to that, there seems to be a groundswell of alarm with Americans here, and some resentment towards the lack of labeling. Is there any movement in the Senate that might correct that? And what are your own personal impressions? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, there have been efforts, you know, for this type of labeling, but none of it has passed yet in the Senate. But when you talk about GMOs, you know, genetically modified organisms, Europe has been very opposed to those, and, you know, they say it's because of their concerns over, you know, they don't know exactly how that's going to affect humans in the long run. They're just coming off from some bad history dealing with the mad cow disease, etc. And the people up in Europe have basically been very resistant to this. There are some of us that believe some of this resistance is for trade advantages. You know, that could be one. But there is also other concerns. There's even growing concern in this country that maybe we've moved too fast with GMOs. And there are many farmers now that are requesting the regular seed rather than GMOs for planting next spring, because they're afraid there might not be a market or that there might be reductions in markets. So you can see that this is having a big effect even on agriculture in this country for local consumption. But GMOs, you know, there has been so many over the years. This has been something that's been ongoing. I mean, if you look at just the tomato, it used to be a very small green berry that was poisonous, and through, you know, genetics has been developed into what we have today in our tomatoes. And a lot of the same thing can be said, and a lot of it is natural genetic alterations as well as, you know, man assisted. So maybe the whole industry has moved a little bit too fast. At least that's what many people around the world and even in this country are saying. But I think what we need to do is have some good education on this, some sound science, and to know exactly where we're going or what are we doing. It's going to be, you know, it's much easier to produce the amount of food the world needs through these new advances. But at the same time, we've got to make sure people are comfortable and that it's safe. And that might just take a little bit better education.
Prescription drugs, they seem to pop up in the news. The cost of prescription drugs has become an increasingly big issue. Should that be part of the standard Medicare package now, that seniors would just have their drugs paid for?
I think we're going to move into a direction in the very near future where prescription drugs are covered as part of Medicare, but to what extent? The president has proposed total coverage of prescription drugs, but up to a limit. And for many Americans, it would be worse than what they're getting now. So it would advantage some, but disadvantage others. You know, but even under the president's plan, even we'd be buying prescription drugs for Bill Gates, for instance. So I think what we have to do is try to focus and target it on those who need the help the most. I've introduced a bill called MEDS, and that is looking for ways of providing these medications and prescription drugs to those who need it the most. And those who have a certain income level would receive these drugs. Others would have to begin with co-payments up to a certain point. If you're only making $600 or $700 a month as benefits from Social Security and your prescriptions are $300, there's no way you can do that. Those are the people we need to help. All the way up to, you know, certain levels. I can't remember offhand, Gary, what those levels are, but it would be like up to $900. Then they would start paying at like a $25 a month copay. And then you go up into higher wages. We, you know, the copay would be increased until it would be phased out. And so it would target those who need the help the most. And I think that's the way Congress is going to go. We can't afford, I don't believe, to provide prescription drugs for everybody. That would be a program that would be so expensive, it would be awfully hard to maintain that. So what we have to do, I think, is find a way to provide the help to those who need it the most. And that's what I think my bill aims at, and I think Congress will move in the direction close to that next year.
Is it possible, likely, that the Congress will actually pass some kind of legislation in this area next year?
It all depends. You know, this is, again, like you've mentioned, a politically charged year coming up. And this will be a high profile and in some cases a controversial type issue. And so it might not get passed next year and it might be held over till 2001. But I would almost assume, Gary, that it's going to either have action on it in the year 2000, and if not 2000, it would be in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Doug, your question, please.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Gary.
Hi.
I was hoping you could clear up some rumors I've been hearing. I'm a kind of outdoorsman, a canoeist, and every once in a while I hear rumors about that you're trying to open up the Boundary Waters canoe area to motorized boats more. Everything from that to more logging to building roads that you're going to sell it to some developers for, you know, this or that. And I was just wondering if you could clear some of that up for me.
No, Doug, our bill never was aimed or intended to do anything to denigrate the Boundary Waters canoe area. What we did and what we fought for up in northern Minnesota was to reopen a couple of portages that had been closed. Portages that would allow people to move motorized boats from one lake to another under the original agreement that formed the Boundary Waters. Even Hubert Humphrey, who, you know, worked very hard on bringing the Boundary Waters into being, said there will always be motors in the Boundary Waters. So in other words, it's not a perfect wilderness, but it was as close as we could get. And all my bill did was to reopen two portages that closed. My bill did not ask for more motors to be allowed. It did not ask for increasing the permits. It did not ask for increasing the number of lakes open to motors. It did not ask to increase the size of the motors. In fact, I said that if any bills asking for those things were introduced, I would fight very hard against them. So we just worked very hard to live up to promises that were made, and that was just basically opening up those two portages. But the rest is all status quo, and we want to make sure the Boundary Water remains the pristine area that it is, that it's there for enjoyment for people today, but for also for our kids and our grandchildren. And that is possible, and that's all my bill asked. So I'm out there very strongly supporting the Boundary Waters, and like I said, I would fight any efforts to open it up to any more development or logging or anything else. We want to keep it the way it is.
Joe is on the line from Moundsview with a question for Senator Grahams. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, my question for Senator Grahams concerns Iraq. The United Nations operating in Iraq has estimated that over 1 million civilians, mostly children, have died from malnutrition and disease mm-hmm. as a result of the sanctions against Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the Oil for Food program is inadequate to address the human need. Moreover, bombing has destroyed much of the civilian infrastructure, causing more misery. The United States is pursuing a policy that harms civilians for a leader they did not elect. Why can't we maintain a military embargo against Iraq while lifting the economic sanctions?
And there are many of us in Congress who have agreed with you, and that is trying to lift the embargoes dealing when it comes to foodstuff and medicines, and because it has created some real hardships for the average Iraqi citizen. But the biggest problem in Iraq has been, continues to be, Saddam Hussein. And we very strongly support, you know, the military embargoes that are against him. The food or the oil for, you know, food embargoes that we're on has allowed him to sell more oil. But again, it's been hard to control where those dollars are being spent. And he has been spending them on palaces and on military rather than, again, on food and other, you know, needs of the Iraqi people. But, you know, our concerns have been the same of many of our allies and European leaders, and that is to try to make sure that the Iraqi people can, you know, have access to adequate food and adequate medical attention. But at the same time, we've got to keep some reins on this madman there, because he would take it and, again, invest in more military hardware and equipment and, you know, as his history has shown, you know, would probably attack another neighbor or do something like that. So I agree. We don't want to degrade the quality of life for the average Iraqi citizen. But the biggest boulder in the way is Saddam Hussein himself. We are taking steps, and I have supported efforts to lift some of those embargoes and sanctions to allow more food and medical aid into Iraq. But again, it's how it gets to the people, and much of that is determined by Saddam himself.
Should the U.S. do anything about the Russian offensive in Chechnya?
I know the president has, you know, had some very strong words for Mr. Yeltsin. It's been discounted. In fact, I think Mr. Yeltsin walked out of a meeting with the president was at in Europe a couple of weeks ago. I think we need to, you know, be concerned about what's going on. But again, this is an internal affair. We don't like to see this happen any more than we did in Bosnia or any more than we did in Kosovo. I don't know what we can do right now short of trying to, you know, get in between the two. And I don't see that happening.
Tony, your question?
Welcome, Senator.
Hi, Tony.
Will you introduce an amendment to the National Labor Relations Act to give the sugar beet migrant farm workers the right to organize?
Boy, Tony, I don't know the details on that. So I can't say yes or no. I've never had any opposition to if workers want to organize and unionize. I've never said that they shouldn't have that opportunity to do that, but I don't know exactly how it, you know, stands or what would be in the way here.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. My concern is the senior citizens' cost for Medicare supplements, mm-hmm. and what we're paying in Minnesota versus what they're paying in Florida, for instance, where they get hearing aids and eyeglasses and trips to the doctor, and everything is paid for, and our premiums continue to increase, and it's based on an unfair formula. And I'd like to know what efforts you're putting into correcting that.
Well, Ruth, we have worked very hard for the last couple of years, and so has other members of the Minnesota delegation. It's been a very good effort, bipartisan effort, but to balance or bring some balance to what is called the AAPCC, and that's the reimbursement formula that Medicare provides. And you're right, many counties in Minnesota were getting only about $200 a month per person, while in Florida it was up to like $750. And you're right, in, you know, rural parts of Minnesota, you could not get HMOs, you could not get, you know, the other, you know, medical things you needed. It was on a fee-for-service type basis. But down in Florida, they could buy everything they wanted. They could get prescription drugs, eyeglasses, all of these things paid for. So it has been very unfair, and the system continues to get even more and more out of whack. And to go back to the history of it, it really started because Minnesota was providing better health care at lower costs than other areas of the country. And when federal programs are put into place to bring balance, they had to end up paying more for, say, people in Florida or other parts of the country. So we've been penalized for our own good efforts. And that just shows you, again, some of the inequities that you can get into in these federal programs when they try to have a cookie-cutter approach. But then, of course, over the last 30 years, as these formulas, you know, if you get, say, a 5% increase on $700, that's $35 increase. But if it's a 5% increase on $200, that's only a $10 increase. So the inequities over the years have continued to get larger and larger. So we did make a good effort this year. All Minnesota counties after this year should be at least up to the national average, and that's about $370. So it has moved up a lot, and we're going to continue to work over the next couple of years to bring even more balance to that. But we have made a good first step in trying to bring some parity to those reimbursement programs from Medicare.
Not a lot of time left, but let's get a couple more questions on here for Senator Grahams. Roy, you're next.
Yes, Senator, I was wondering what you thought about this Cuban boy that's being held hostage in Florida and becoming a political pawn. You think the boy should be returned to his natural father?
Well, right now, at first blush, I would say no. And he has become a political pawn, but I think it's been done by Fidel Castro. I think he has tried to make this into a political issue. My understanding is that the father could claim very easily custody, but he would just have to come to this country and make the appeal in a U.S. court, and it would be heard. But my understanding is that Castro does not want him to come, and maybe he's afraid that if the father came here, he too would ask for asylum and stay. So I think Fidel Castro is, again, using this as a political issue, using this boy, I think, as the political pawn you've mentioned. But right now, I would not support returning him to Cuba.
How is it that we can do business with the Chinese and all kinds of other governments all around the world, but we just can't seem to get past this Cuba issue? I mean, here's a little country 90 miles off our shore, long history of close ties with the U.S., and while relations generally improve with all the other countries in the world, that just sits there.
Well, for 38 years plus, Gary, we've had these embargoes against the Cubans. And really, we've tried to, again, in part of the bills that I've co-sponsored, along with, say, like many Democrats on our committees, to lift some of the embargoes on Cuba, dealing mainly, again, with agricultural products, food, and medicines, again, to help the Cuban people. And we've had many non-government organizations, many religious organizations, church groups that said that they would help and make sure that the food and medicine got to the people and not to the Cuban army or the military or the, you know, government. So we've tried to lift that, but we've never been able to. There is very strong opposition in Congress to that, even though, you know, we've tried to raise those embargoes or lift them. They've been shot down. So right now we're still at a status quo with Fidel Castro. And like you said, we've been able to do other things with other countries. But I don't think we're going to be able to do much at all because of the strong opposition by many in Congress until Fidel Castro is gone one way or the other. My fear is I don't know who's going to replace Castro. And I think that we need to, you know, work with the people of Cuba and hopefully move them toward a democracy. But if we don't and if we keep these fences around Cuba, the next leader could be another Fidel Castro. And then what are we going to be in for, another 40 years of the same type of totalitarian regime? So that's what we're afraid of. We don't know what the future holds for Cuba.
Can't let you go without talking a little bit of politics. All these Democrats are lined up. A lot of other people say they might be running. Is this good or bad news for you?
Well, of course, we'd like to have run unopposed in 2000, Gary. But we knew this was going to be a tough race, and I know there are many Democrats that are, you know, are now in the race or considering it, and that's fine. And, you know, we'll have an opponent also from the Reform Party. But right now we have no say in that. We have no vote on who our opponent will be. So all we can do is, I think, what I'm trying to focus on and concentrate on is doing what the people of Minnesota elected me to do, and that's do my job in Washington. And I'm focusing very strongly on that, working on the policy issues. There's time for politics. But I always say I'm kind of like the Vikings. You know, I want to be in the Super Bowl. Right now we are not concerned in who the opponent will be. We just want to make sure that once the season starts, that we're prepared and can win, and that's what we're going to do.
Now, so, for president, you're supporting George W. Bush.
Right. I'm an honorary co-chair in Minnesota for George W. Bush. I think he's created a lot of excitement. He's got a great opportunity to win, and again, this is going to be a very good and interesting race.
What was the what was this business about John McCain being unstable?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that, was that from your fellow senators?
I haven't heard any of the senators, the Republican senators or Democratic senators, ever say anything that John McCain might be unstable or that his temper might not lend him to be president of the United States. I don't know where it came from, and I don't think there's been anybody that's been named as have said that. John McCain, I think, is a good individual, and I have no reason to believe that he would not be competent to be president of the United States. The question is he going to get enough support from the voters? I think that's the bottom line. But I don't know where these rumors started, and I think they'll go away in a short period of time.
Big issue next year in the Senate campaign here in Minnesota. What do you think it's going to be, the one or two big issues?
Well, I think a lot of it always comes down to, you know, the economic issues. You know, even President Clinton said in 1992, it's the economy, stupid. You know, things dealing with people's, you know, salaries, their incomes, their jobs, the tax issues, those are all very important issues. And that's why I'm, you know, I continue to fight for those issues to make sure that we have a very strong economy, that we have good jobs in this country. But we also got to look at our tax load, because our net income very much is determined by the amount of taxes we pay. I still think we need tax relief. And like the surplus in Minnesota, again, I'd say that should all be given back. I would like to see the surplus in Washington given back. Surpluses are surplus that means overcharges. And so, you know, other issues are going to be important as well, health care, education. But a lot of it will always boil down to one of the most important things when voters go to the polls, and that is the economy.
Senator, thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Gary. Thank you very much.